As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, and the respondent will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just approach the microphone. Please adjust the podium to your level and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an assistant public defender, and I have the pleasure of representing the appellant, Alan Lawrence Scarsella. Your Honors, Mr. Scarsella has presented this court with multiple bases for reversal, and I would like to focus on two of those arguments today. That is the denial of his post-conviction petition and the denial of his motion to suppress. The post-conviction court clearly erred by making incorrect findings about critically important facts and then relying on those incorrect findings to deny Mr. Scarsella's post-conviction claims. Because we have established at the very least enough to warrant an evidentiary hearing, this court should reverse for such a hearing. Secondly, the district court erred by denying Mr. Scarsella's motion to suppress the evidence obtained from his cell phone. The warrant was insufficiently particular, and the illustrative list could not be severed from the warrant. Even if this court believes that that list could be severed, the list was still not supported by probable cause. This court should reverse and grant a new trial. Now, regarding the first issue, the post-conviction issue, I'd like to address this court about what facts the district court got wrong. And those facts concerned the evidence submitted by the defense as part of the post-conviction petition's exhibits. The court found that those were all turned over by the state prior to trial. That is absolutely 100% incorrect. All of those exhibits were found by Mr. Scarsella's defense team after trial, after sentencing, many months after sentencing, as part of a post-conviction investigation. None of those documents were ever turned over to post-conviction counsel.
Ms. Workman, I just want to, on one of those points, I want to make sure absolutely. You're stating that the list of WH's interactions with the police officers prior to trial was not turned over to the
defense.
None
of those were turned over. Okay. All of those were discovered by myself and other members of our team during the post-conviction investigation, Your Honor.
And had they been turned over, is it your argument that that would have led then to an inquiry as to the reputation for violence evidence of this witness?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So my question for you then is, the defense called Officer Aguirre, who apparently had knowledge of that information. Couldn't they have easily discovered that through a diligent investigation by simply asking Officer Aguirre?
I have 2 points to address that as part of my answer here, Your Honor. First off, I'm sure you're familiar with that phrase, you don't know what you don't know. Yes, there was an as part of calling Officer Aguirre as a defense witness, there was an interview done with the defense team beforehand, and yes, he was asked questions. But you can't ask questions that you don't know about. And secondly, that creates a fact question or perhaps a legal question that needs to be resolved by the district court, the post-conviction court, at an evidentiary hearing. What constitutes a diligent, reasonable investigation? That is something that the post-conviction court cannot resolve without such a hearing. We made a much more than adequate showing in our claims, in our petition, to get a hearing. The fact that it was denied on incorrect findings warrants reversal for such a hearing. Now, Your Honors, I know that the state has put forward an argument of, well, shouldn't we, you know, what we're asking for is, should we have to go out and interview every officer who's involved here? No, that's not what we're asking for here. Officer Aguirre was a known factor in this case. And let me just step back and give you some of the facts that may not be super clear from the pleadings here. Officer Aguirre authored a supplemental report. He was there at the 4th Precinct the day of the shooting. He authored a supplemental report about what he witnessed, which was some of the protesters around the 4th Precinct itself. That report was turned over to the defense as part of pretrial discovery. And that is how the defense came to know of Officer Aguirre and then called him as a witness. Now, the obligation to disclose this Brady type of information falls upon members of the prosecution staff, but also police officers who are participating in the investigation or the evaluation of the case. He is an essential witness to establishing what the protest was like and the atmosphere there for the riot charge. He's part of the evaluation of the case. Therefore, his information is imputed to the state, and that information should have been turned over to Mr. Scarsella's defense team.
Ms. Workman, is there anything in the supplemental report that discussed WH's reputation for violence?
The supplemental report that Officer Aguirre authored? No,
yes.
It does not. That was new information that we discovered after Mr. Hoskins was criminally charged himself, and it came up at a hearing in his case. That was brand new to us at that point. And that was obviously after our sentencing.
So in the supplemental, does the supplemental report just sort of talk about what's going on that night?
That's my understanding. Okay. Your Honor, I have not read the supplemental report, but my understanding is that is what it is.
Okay.
Yes.
So assuming that the information should have been disclosed and it wasn't, for the purpose of my question here, getting to the ultimate issue of viewing the evidence as a whole, how was the district court wrong in saying that even if that's all true, the jury still heard from Mr. Scarsella that he believed Mr. Hoskins had a knife? The jury heard evidence, considerable evidence, that the protesters, including Mr. Hoskins, were aggressive toward Mr. Scarsella that night. So if we look at the evidence as a whole that the jury heard, how was the district court wrong in saying there was no reasonable probability that even if the information should have been and had been disclosed, it could have made any difference in how the jury ruled in the case ultimately?
Let me bring you back to the heart of this case. And the heart of this case is the credibility of Mr. Hoskins versus the credibility of Mr. Scarsella. None of the other witnesses who were around at that point were in a place where they could view what occurred between Mr. Hoskins and Mr. Scarsella. So you have to go on.
But credibility is an issue for the jury to make a determination on. And they heard all that evidence and they made their determination.
Well,
so how does that impact the post-conviction analysis?
Respectfully, Your Honor, they did not hear all the evidence. They did not hear evidence of Mr. Hoskins' reputation for violence, which very much materially impacts a credibility determination, and credibility determinations here impact a guilty or not guilty verdict. Ultimately, it comes down to, do I believe Mr. Scarsella's account of, I felt threatened because I saw Mr. Hoskins pull a knife, or do I believe...
And no knife was never found.
No knife was found, Your Honor.
Okay.
But also, Mr. Hoskins was transported to a hospital. Who knows what could have happened in that time frame. Also, it could be that without hearing Mr. Hoskins' reputation for violence, it becomes much more believable that his account that he didn't pull a knife is what happened. And that's probably what the jury went with here. If they had heard...
I read that in your brief, but... it seems like that's a very narrow view of the evidence when we're looking at the evidence as a whole in making credibility determinations. And so was the district court required to really narrow it down that finely, saying Hoskins versus Scarsella, as opposed to maybe that's a factor, but looking at the evidence as a whole?
Well, I think the evidence as a whole shows that it does come down to Hoskins versus Scarsella. And essentially, especially for the count regarding the assault of Mr. Hoskins. And the district court did not disagree with us on that count. The district court did adopt our view of things there, that it was hard for the other witnesses to see what was going on. So it really does come down to, do you believe Mr. Hoskins? And Mr. Hoskins was the first one who was shot. So it does turn on, did something happen there? An interaction happened there? And who do you believe? This evidence changes the whole view of that. And that's why it's so material. My second point to your question, Judge Flory, is that the post-conviction court's analysis is sort of dichotomous and it can't be resolved within itself. The court simultaneously finds that, yes, this is material, important information, but then does not factor that in to the prejudice analysis. The court does not goes on to sort of like a sufficiency analysis and says, well, you know, there's all this other evidence, so therefore I'm going to deny. That's not the analysis the court should be approaching this with. The court should apply the reasonable possibility. That's a much lower, easier standard to meet, and we did meet that. Is there a reasonable possibility that if the jurors had known that Mr. Hoskins has a reputation for violence, that they would have believed Mr. Scarsella's account, at least with respect to the assault charge with Mr. Hoskins? Yes.
Is the standard possibility or probability?
You know what? Let's look at that. It's probability, Your Honor, from Peterson.
And just so that I'm clear, Ms. Workman, no one else, the record indicates there's no evidence that anyone else saw a knife besides your client.
Mr. Gustafson, I don't want to say equivocates on that, but he does say he believes he saw it on cross-examination. He sort of takes that back a little bit. There's evidence from other witnesses that Mr. Scarsella said that he had seen a knife, and that was why he shot. From the woman who was at the home of Mr. Suarez, where all the four men went after the shooting, she recounted that. I believe Officer Levin, who
recounted that Scarsella told her there was a
knife? Correct, okay. When he was saying what had happened. And then I believe Officer Levin in the phone call also said that Mr. Scarsella told him a knife was pulled. Your Honors, if there are no other questions about that issue, I see that my time is dwindling here, and I would like to spend some time on the motion to suppress issue. As you know, we have argued that the warrant was not sufficiently particular and that illustrative list could not be severed. Those arguments have been fully briefed. I'd like to discuss right now the probable cause argument. If this court does find that illustrative list is severable, that list still must be supported by probable cause. It is not. The warrant application itself is vague and lacks any specifics that would give that court enough to find that there is probable cause. The application to the warrant only avers that Mr. Scarsella was at the protest and made a phone call to Levin. If that is the metric to search a phone, then everyone around at that protest should have had their phone searched. We can see that there's enough probable cause there to search the call logs, but that's where it stops. After that, the court engaged in pure speculation to find probable cause, relying upon such things as, quote-unquote, common knowledge that phones are used at these events and that everyone knows that you will record and try to make this event famous. That's not enough to give probable cause, what everyone knows and common knowledge, and there's no authority cited by the state or by the court that would give probable cause under those circumstances. Probable cause is under the totality of the circumstances a fair probability that connects the contraband to the crime, and that we are lacking here.
Well, the affidavit did say that he had used his phone to call Officer Levin, where he talked about the evidence, or talked about the incident. you know, the signing judge had to make a common sense determination of whether there was a fair probability. Wouldn't common sense from that judge's perspective and the deference given to the signing judge indicate that Mr. Scarsella was using his phone to discuss what had happened? And why wasn't it reasonable for the court to, at that early stage in the investigation, to allow law enforcement to look at the calls that he had made, text messages that he had sent that might pertain to what had happened that evening?
I will answer your question quickly and then move on. Your Honor, first off, these officers, this was not as early of a stage of the investigation. They had already searched his home pursuant to another warrant. They knew about his gun collection. They knew who the men were who were involved. They knew they had collected evidence from his home. They'd already arrested those other people. And so at this stage, they had the ability to be much more specific and to give much more information in that warrant application. It is on those officers to do so. It is on the court to hold them to that. The court should have held them to it. I'm not advocating for us all to set aside common sense, but common sense, based on pure speculation, is not probable cause. We hold ourselves to a higher standard than that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Workman. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The post-conviction court did not abuse its discretion, nor did the trial court err or abuse her discretion in the rulings, and we ask this court to affirm. To start
Mr. Schmidt, do you agree that the list of WH's interactions was not provided prior to trial with the police officer?
I thought that the police reports with his interactions with the police were disclosed. The list, I don't think, was disclosed. And I think that may be slightly different than what my brief says, but I believe the police reports were disclosed.
Was the supplemental report yet was or was not disclosed of officer, I guess, is, I didn't know how to pronounce it, Acquiar?
That report was disclosed. His report, and this gets right to the heart of the Brady issue and what the state needs to disclose. Under Rule 9, the state has to disclose material information from those who participated or investigated in the investigation or evaluation of the case. Officer Eggers' report was disclosed, but his only involvement in the entire situation was being present at the precinct during the protests. He didn't investigate Mr. Scarsella. He didn't investigate any of his friends. He didn't evaluate their case.
But I mean, is it fair to say that the other officer did tell Acquiar that he knew about Hoskins, that he'd had interactions with Hoskins and you know, Hoskins, you know, was violent, had a reputation for violence? You know, is that a fair statement?
Yes. Officer Schroeder told Officer Aguiar that he believed WH was violent.
And he expected that Aguilar would tell the defense when he met with them about his concerns.
I think what the post-conviction petition says is that Officer Schroeder said, tell the defense WH was had
and
a
propensity Aguilar for God.
He never passed that along to the defense when they met and interviewed. And Aguiar,
I mean, that seems to be a problem, isn't it? That seems to be a problem to me. Apart from the reasonable probability issue, you know, that's something that should have been disclosed, particularly since the officer himself was sort of volunteering and saying, "Oh, by the way, let them know," blah blah blah.
And I don't know why Officer Aguiar didn't pass it along, but my argument along the Brady violation is that Officer Aguiar was not a participant or an evaluator of the charges. So under Rule 9, the state did not have an obligation to disclose it because he did not participate in the investigation or evaluation of the case. His only involvement in the case was being present at the precinct during the protests. He was included on the defense's witness list.
Let me get this straight. What if, I've forgotten his name now, whoever told Aguilar, you know what? Thank you, Judge Kirk. What if Schroeder had said, Hoskins had a knife, or better yet, Hoskins had a gun and shot first. Best tell the defendant that. Are you telling me that wouldn't have been disclosed simply because, and he told that to Aguilar, because Aguilar wasn't, you know, on the investigative team. He was just at the police station that night.
Well, and let me be clear. We conceded that this evidence would be favorable to the appellant. And that goes to the favorability factor. What we are contending is that because Aguilar was not a participant in the investigation or evaluation of the case, of Scarcella's actions or any of his friends' actions, that under Rule 9 there was no obligation to disclose the information that he learned from a different officer who had, there's no dispute that Mr. Officer
Schroeder. So if Levin had said, you know what, I shot them and I've been paying everyone off and I feel guilty now, you should probably tell that to the defense. Because Aguilar wasn't part of the investigative team, Aguilar would have had no obligation to disclose that, to disclose that.
Under Rule 9, I think, you know, once we make the facts further and further along, they get more and more egregious.
Well, rather than go down this road, would you address our concerns dealing with, or as Judge Flory ably pointed out, you know, this wouldn't have made much of a difference because they had been hammering the issue of that Mr. Scarcella was fearful of his life.
Correct, and that goes to the third Brady factor, which is our other contention that Scarcella suffered no prejudice here, and it is a reasonable probability that it sufficiently undermined the outcome in the case. And looking at the evidence of the whole, this wasn't limited to the credibility of WH versus the credibility of Scarcella. There were other people who testified as to the exact events that occurred, including Mr. Gustafson, who was part of Mr. Scarcella's group. And within that, Gustafson at first said, well, I thought I saw something shiny. And then on cross-examination, he backed off from that and conceded he did not actually see a weapon, and that's at 2202 of the transcript. So that leaves Scarcella alone saying he saw a weapon, and that's a fact that he never actually even told his girlfriend, who testified that she didn't know that there was any weapon involved, that Scarcella saw any weapon. So there is ample evidence that the jury heard here that the protesters were hostile, that the protesters were the initial aggressors. The protesters threatened to beat Scarcella and Gustafson. WH specifically threatened Scarcella. Protesters said to them, white boy, you're going to die. Gustafson was punched. Gustafson and Scarcella talked about being a few feet away from the protesters. And the defense even argued in closing argument that WH specifically threatened Scarcella, and then Scarcella then acted in self-defense. There was ample evidence that the jury just didn't believe that the protesters were the initial aggressors. Having additional evidence of another police officer saying, well, I know that this person might be violent, doesn't add to that calculus given the evidence that the jury did hear. But even if the jury did believe that there may have been a weapon involved, they could still find that this was not a reasonable response that Scarcella took in self-defense. First of all, WH was shot in the back. He was not shot in the front. Only TK was the victim who was shot in the abdomen and had life-threatening injuries. WH was shot in the front first, in the back, excuse me, first. Then he was shot a second time in the right leg after he was trying to run away. But besides those two shots, there were six other shots that Scarcella took at that time. And this mitigates against the claim that any response he had at that time was reasonable.
You know, and you're right. I think those are very, very salient factors on the reasonable probability. You know, but, you know, if the judge had known about the whole issue of Hoskins' reputation for violence, perhaps it would have been more likely that the district court would have given the jury instruction that the defense wanted. What about that?
Well, the instruction that was given was a standard jig instruction, and what they wanted
which
was...
Which is always, you know, the one I'd give, but the whole point is, my question is, Mr. Schmidt, if this reputation for violence had come out ahead of time, you know, maybe the district court would have entertained, you know, a do-it-yourself instruction and say, well, you know...
And I don't think that instruction was warranted even if that evidence had come out, because there was ample evidence about the protesters being hostile and having threatening Scarcella and his group, actually punching Gustafson in the eye. And as to the jury instruction, the instruction, the modified instruction that defense wanted was to talk about a good deal greater than mere conversation does not alone, the words alone do not forfeit self-defense. But the word that was used here and within the context of the evidence is the protesters were telling Scarcella and his group to take off their masks because they were wary of people wearing masks at the protest from Scarcella's previous video where they were there and mocking these protesters and making fun of them and worried and seeing somebody hold up a gun to the camera. They were concerned about people taking off masks. They didn't take off the masks. The protesters were following them and yelling at them as Scarcella and his group were leaving. In the video evidence, you can see the protesters stop. Somebody says, of the protesters, says, let's go back. They start turning back. But then something happens. And that something is somebody from Scarcella's group shouted the N-word at a group of African Americans at a Black Lives Matter protest, in order which had the intended reaction. It sparked something, and it sparked a reaction. And this goes right to the text messages from Scarcella, where he wanted to cause a reaction so he could shoot black people. That goes right into the heart of the evidence. So the N-word, in the context of which it was used in the whole of the evidence, shows that this was far beyond mere conversation. This was something that was intended to incite a reaction, and it had that very effect. But to get to the warrant questions, I brought up the text messages, so I'll go to the warrant. For purposes of this appeal, we have conceded that the all data language was overly broad. The rest of the seven specifically listed items were specific enough in order to obtain them. And regarding the probable cause, which counsel focused on for argument, the officer's affidavit said Scarcella used his phone to call a friend, and that goes to the call log, which counsel said that the police had at least that. But it is the signing judge is allowed to use reasonable inferences. And from that, since Scarcella had already communicated with people about this specific thing, it's reasonable to infer that he may have sent text messages to others about this specific thing.
What about
thing.
Photos, videos, and recordings?
Again, it's a reasonable inference that somebody at a protest could take photos, could take videos. And specifically, we know that Scarcella did this in the past because at the protest, when he went there he was recording that
right,
protest.
But I mean, that's not in the affidavit that Scarcella went to them. Where is that?
That's not in the affidavit. Okay. No, but a reasonable inference from the whole of the investigation. But in particular...
Look, I would be... I mean, all we have to look at is, he was at the Black Lives Matter protest on November 23rd, 2015. I would certainly agree with you that people go to protests often people take videos of everything every time. So I suppose you got that. But I mean, there's also no temporal limitation on this. I mean, this could go back to, I guess I would feel a little better if there was, you know, all this stuff going back, you know, pick a date, 6 months. But there's not even that.
There's not. And
so what are we supposed to do? Well, you know, it was a big case. Wink, wink. You know, nod, nod. What are we supposed to do? What opinion are we going to write that says, even if you separate the all data, that this is a good search warrant? And how do we write that?
It's based on the, and I don't know how to pronounce this, but the Hen-Casella case and the Miller case from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1990 and 2003. It's whether a more precise description is possible given the nature of the activity under investigation. The nature of this activity under investigation is that this is the second time this person returned to the protest. The first time somebody...
Which is not in the affidavit.
Somebody displaying a gun. But when he goes back to the protest, we know he had a gun with him. We know that he had a mask on.
Right, but that's... yes, all of that is true. But none of that is in the affidavit.
But the nature of the crime under investigation, what we don't know is what was his motive. Was this premeditated? There's questions here. Did he know these people in the past? Was he specifically targeting these individuals? We don't know those questions. And so the nature of the crime under investigation is that we can't be more specific because we need to get into the motive. And unless the court has any other questions, I see that my time is expiring, and we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Ms. Workman, you'll have the last word, please.
Your Honors, just a couple of points. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Regarding the reports that were disclosed, I'll just again reiterate that none of those reports were disclosed, not the contact log with Mr. Hoskins, not the report from the officer that was written after Mr. Scarsella's trial was over with, none of the reputation evidence, nothing from Officer Schroeder. None of that was turned over to the defense before, during, and then before sentencing, before, during trial. Your Honors, I'd like to discuss this point that Mr. Schmidt makes about the ample evidence, the so-called ample evidence that the jury had. That ample evidence of Mr. Scarsella not being the aggressor was not believed because the jury didn't have any evidence before them of Mr. Hoskins' reputation for violence. They had no evidence affecting his credibility before them. This evidence, this reputation evidence, is like a bomb that goes off here. It is so material that it definitely could have made this go the other way. And that's why there's not only a reasonable probability here, we believe we've also made the showing for a new trial as well.
Ms. Workman, and obviously I'm sure you don't have it. It's an unpublished opinion from Judge Bjorkman for our court, State v. Taylor, 2018 Westlaw 1462324. It also deals with a search warrant. There it was for a phone. The underlying crime was sex trafficking, prostitution, and you know, Judge Bjorkman, one of our most thoughtful colleagues, pretty much swipes away this overbroad argument that you've made here. I mean, she writes, Taylor also asserts, that's the defendant, the warrant is insufficiently particular in describing the contents of the phone to be searched. He contends that a warrant must specify the type of data to be searched, such as call logs, text messages, and emails. Or it impermissibly allows police to search the entirety of the phone without any limitations or expectations. We are not persuaded. And there she points out, contrary to Taylor's argument, the police had specific expectations in examining the digital contents of his cell phone. They sought evidence of sex trafficking and prostitution. A search for such evidence on a cell phone predictably encompasses the standard communication elements of the phone, including text messages and call logs. It also encompasses a wide range of evidence pursuant to the offenses under investigation, such as seizing photos, social media information, financial information, contact information, and links linked to prostitution. Why here isn't it enough to say, you know, he shot five people, There was a Black Lives, it was done at a Black Lives protest where he shot five protesters. Common sense would indicate that there would be information, that photos, videos, and recordings that might provide evidence related to the commission of these crimes.
I want to harp upon or seize upon what I think is a really good quote from that Taylor decision, Your Honors, and that is that there are no specific expectations here in this case that are given in that warrant application. They were looking for everything, and we know that the police did not feel limited by that illustrative list, because when you look at the inventory list that they filed along with the warrant, they took all digital info, everything from that phone. So not just some of the things listed in that illustrative list, which is a very broad category anyway, they took everything. So there's no specific expectation of what they're looking for. They're going on a general exploratory search here, which is specifically prohibited by the Constitution. Your Honor, I would just like to point out that the facts that the state is using to back up the warrant argument here are facts that came out afterwards. They're not facts that appear in the warrant application, and nobody knew about, or they weren't given to the court at the time that the warrant was applied for. That cannot stand. There's not probable cause. This warrant was not sufficiently particular, and Your Honors should find that a new trial should be granted.
Thank you, Ms. Workman. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. The matter was well argued and well presented. The matter is now submitted. Please give our warmest regards to Ms. Rankin and Ms. Workman.